to begin with, I'd like you, first of all, to try and think of some experience that you have had recently that has made you feel very positive about yourself. Something that has happened to you that has made you feel very positive about yourself.
I guess I can think of one, and that was recently I took a group of Lutheran leaguers on an outing, a trip to Minneapolis. Didn't know what their reactions were really, because they were very reserved. And yet, the day or two after we got back, they presented my wife and I with a cake and, you know, at church that day.
Uh-huh.
So that was really neat to get that feedback.
Very positive feedback. Very nice. Thank you. Somebody else like to share? Yes.
Seeing someone whose face is familiar and comes up and recognizes you after 10 years.
Exactly, exactly. There was something going on all of that time. It's very positive.
You've been connected over the years.
Very nice. Yes.
I felt good about coming here. I did it without knowing anything about it. And I left my children and husband at home. He's babysitting. Mm-hmm. It's just sort of an adventure, something I haven't done in a long time.
So perhaps you're feeling good about the sort of independence that you're taking on your own.
Right,
great. I admire that. It's very fun. Thank you.
Just don't try to call it.
That's exactly right, exactly. Okay. Now let's do the opposite. That was a time when you felt good about yourself and you felt positive about the way that you were handling your life, in a sense, that in some ways you were making a difference, or you were taking responsibility, or you had made a difference in the past. Can you think of an experience recently when you have had just the opposite kind of feeling, when you felt very displeased with something that you did or something that you said? I will share one thing. I made a remark in a group not very long ago that turned out to be a very racist remark, and I felt really, it was one of those things you'd like to take back, you know, the minute you said it and you couldn't take it back, and I kind of lamely apologized for making it, but that, you know, that made me feel very, very uncomfortable. Yes.
I had a wedding a while ago and I just forgot to have the people sit down.
Oh no.
So they stood as the bride came in, and they stood all through the solo, the sermon, and all this stuff. And all of a sudden, I looked out there, and they were sitting. And I couldn't remember ever having them sit down, and it was just terrible. I mean, they stood for, you know, 14 minutes or something like that.
They were very courteous and very patient. The bride probably wrote that down in her book of memories. Yeah. Everybody stood for the wedding, huh? Very nice. Yeah, but you do feel badly. You know, those kind of opposite extremes of feeling are the, I guess, the guidelines, I might say, for what I want to think about. All of us have times when we feel good about ourselves, and all of us have times when we feel badly about ourselves. And of course, it's much more pleasant to feel good about the things that you do, the decisions you make, and the actions that you take. And the focus of this is to be a parenting workshop. So we're thinking about how we can make it more frequent for children to have those good and positive feelings about themselves. And we want to talk about self-esteem. The first thing that I'd like to do, and I've been a teacher too long not to use a chalkboard. I've never used a whiteboard before. This is neat. But when you hear this, just this term, I don't know if the line is. When you hear the term self-esteem, what kinds of things come to your mind, or what kinds of associations do you make with that term? What do you think about when you think? There are a number of you here, so you. Something clicks about that. What does it say to you? What does it make you think of?
Ego.
All right. Ego would be one thing.
Self-caring.
Good.
Sure.
Just want to get some different thoughts up.
valuable and worth okay. So self worth or self value. Okay.
Confidence.
Did you say confidence?
I said confidence.
Confidence.
Yeah. That's right.
Confidence. That works too.
I'm a teacher also, and I think of positive reinforcement.
Yes. Positive reinforcement. Okay. Any other things that come to mind? Yes.
Just the idea of health and healthy yourself.
Okay. And you would just like that, healthy. Sometimes I can't spell and talk.
Being lovable.
Being lovable?
Okay. Those are all real positive, and there are, when I hear self-esteem, it can be negative.
Are you speaking up there? Okay.
And so maybe, I can think of people who have low self-esteem,
sure.
So then they see failure as...
Okay. So you're saying that all of these are maybe positive. We could think of some negative associations. Failure might be one.
Very critical, usually very critical of others and themselves.
Okay.
Are we thinking here of lacking self-esteem?
Well, she was making the decision that these tended to be positives, okay. And that these tended to be, I mean, all that we had said were positive, and right now we're just sort of making associations. Or self-critical or critical of others, even one.
Probably want to put accepted and up above.
Okay, you could put accepted.
Rejected below.
Sure. We can play opposite. Any others that you'd like to offer?
I'm thinking of attitude. You know, having a loving, caring openness to your attitude, not good self-esteem.
Okay.
And an attitude of being closed and critical that it's been put there.
Right, that's a good point. A good expansion.
Yeah.
Yes.
To me, having good self-esteem means a certain continuity of mind and body, or there's a wholeness.
Mm-hmm. Which is kind of what you were getting at, I think.
Very
a kind of wholeness.
Full.
Uh-huh. Very good. Thank you. What I want to propose, and I think it's evident that we would be in agreement on this, is that self-esteem is very important and very powerful, and I think that's sort of what you were getting at when you talked about the openness as opposed to feeling very closed. If you had to say why you think self-esteem is important, we talk so much about developing self-esteem in children, why is it important that we do a good job of that as parents and as teachers? What kind of, you know, of children do we hope to produce, I guess, in a sense?
Kind, loving, caring, open.
Okay, kind, loving, caring, and open.
Stable.
Very stable children, all right.
Happy
children.
Giving children.
Okay.
I guess what we might as well call a self-actualized person. They're self-reliant rather than letting society put the vet dictate their value.
They feel in control of what they do. All right.
Successful.
it's a kind of opposite of it. My students who have low self-esteem seem to be unable to do much, and they, I think, misinterpret situations, and they feel rejected when they're not rejected, for example.
Right.
Not seeing the world as it truly is.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And this, I think, doing things, he said, and that's how you experience life and how you grow and learn, and as you are able to reach out from yourself. Mm-hmm. With low self-esteem, you're unable to do that.
That's a very good point. It's
and then maybe you reach out for drugs or something, too.
Uh-huh. Yes, I saw a hand there.
Once I was in a class, they were talking about this, and they said the person quoted statistics on for pregnancies and suicides, and with teenagers especially, that those teenagers that had low self-esteem found themselves, or they were in those kinds of situations. Mm-hmm.
So it can lead to very unhappy situations.
I guess, Ben. I want to add to, not to oppose, but to add to what somebody said about success is people who can deal with failures, and I don't think that's much. It's almost impossible to do if you don't have really high self-esteem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a matter of people who are willing to take the risk of failing. I think that's what we're called to Christians. As Christians to be, as people who take risks.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really the only those people who have some degree of self-esteem that are going to be willing to do that and risk the failures that might be involved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I'd like to call that courage.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's kind of a lot of parents' courage to try new things, to get in front of a group and speak.
Mm-hmm.
I think that falls into self-esteem.
One of the things that keeps coming up in some of the literature that I'm reading talks about individuals having the courage to make a mistake, which is sort of what you're getting at, that a person who feels good about themselves is willing to take a risk.
We've seen that those that have a high self-esteem can rely on their own inner strength to get them through situations, whereas maybe those that have low self-esteem may end up relying on other outside influences such as the drugs,
mm-hmm,
and so forth, mm-hmm, to result in another bad experience. Mm-hmm. Continues to foster
which is right, and certainly something we would desire for our children, to have the strength to make their own decisions.
Sometimes it seems like the opposite can happen too, where people with so low self-esteem can rely so much on themselves so that they become bullies or those who are super critical of people. And I've run into that situation where you can just see their self-esteem is so low, mm-hmm, so they try to make themselves more than they really are.
Mm-hmm. And it's a front. Excuse me. Yes, Paul.
I just expand on that and say that I think there's a tendency, I think, particularly in our culture, to overemphasize a certain kind of independence that can become an isolation or a defense. And I think high self-esteem can also be an acknowledging of your need for other people. A strong person is somebody who's willing to be vulnerable and is willing to acknowledge the depth of their vulnerability and their need for other people, not in a way that's that undermines, in a sense, what is an is not counter to independence necessarily,
but it's an honest recognition of
their need for other people, and that's part of the openness that I think we were
talking about
before.
I think we live in a society
that's
so overemphasizes independence, and individuality in a way that denies
the ways in which we're interdependent, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very helpful.
What about Maslow's? His hierarchy of needs other than the survival one.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, somebody mentioned self-actualization,
mm-hmm,
a good reputation,
mm-hmm,
and to feel loved and wanted, mm-hmm, along with some of the autonomy to do it and still be a caring and responsible person to meet those expectations.
Right, exactly.
Because basically, I feel that's a very positive person,
mm-hmm,
and has a good positive self-image.
Sure. perhaps we should think about how it is that you accomplish this with people. It's easy to sit and define what the goal is. And I want us to share together, first of all, after one small thing I want to say, some ideas that you might have, and then I have some ideas that I have taken from other folk. But in doing the background reading for this evening, two things kept recurring to me that are strongly supported out of the research, and I want to be sure that those are kind of on the table as we think about ways that we can develop self-esteem in children. But the first of these is something that really is obvious, and something that I know that I tend to forget, is that we get from children what we expect from children. That we get from children and other adults what we expect from children. I teach college students, I teach teachers, and one of the suggestions that I very often make to my student teachers when they're in the courses immediately before they go out to student teach is that they don't look at their students' permanent records until they have had the students for at least 6 weeks. And I hope that you can see the logic in that, because you know, you set up expectations for students. The teacher's lounge is just as dangerous a place, probably more dangerous, because you get all of the scuttlebutt about the class that you are going to have the next year. Sometimes that's not a real, not looking at the records is not a real practical situation, because certainly you have to have some information. But I overstate it to make the point that you will tend to get from these students exactly what you expect from them. There was a situation in this book too that I guess that rang true with me, having a child who likes to help. I'm thinking of David here, but this is an example of a parent who expected the worst and got it. Sally, 7, the middle of 3, wanted to help mother carry the newly purchased glasses into the house. "No, Sally, I'll do it. You might drop them." "Please, mother, I'll be careful." "Well, all right, but for heaven's sake, don't drop them." Mother picked up several packages and followed her daughter. While going up the steps, Sally stepped on her coat, lost her balance, and fell with the glasses. She burst into tears. Mother put her packages down in despair, opening the box of glasses, and found that all but two were broken. Furious, she broke into a tirade. And then the rest of it goes on to talk about how she could have responded to that situation in a more helpful way. There's another example in this book about a mother who sends her little 4-year-old off to be with a child about the age of the one in the back here, and says, "Now go and play and don't hurt the baby." And of course, the next thing, the baby's screaming because the older child had hit the baby. But, you know, in those very subtle kinds of ways, maybe not so subtle, we communicate to children exactly what we expect of them. Another kind of basic principle that I think underlies a lot of what we might say about developing self-esteem is something that I say to students a lot, to my student teachers, is that nothing breeds success like success. And one thing I often say to try to shake them up is that they, you know, and there's a lot of public emphasis, certainly in accountability of teachers, but I say to them very often that children's failures are teachers' faults, because teachers sometimes set inappropriate or unrealistic objectives and goals for their students. That you need to be very sensitive about the student's capabilities, and of course you need to stimulate and encourage, but there are limits to what some children are capable of doing, and that you need to be sensitive to that. So we talk about that. There is a reading program that Sarah and I was speaking with, I know one of the temporary staff about this, or one of the volunteer staff, called Success in Reading and Writing, which is based on this premise exactly. And the idea is that no child who works in the program will fail, because children are not compared with each other. They're only compared against their own progress. And it's a whole schedule, language arts, reading and writing program. But it seems to me that those two basic principles kind of underlie, or will have to underlie, our thinking about what we can do to help children develop self-esteem. First of all, the fact that you get what you expect from children, and that nothing breeds success like success. Let's talk about some things that you think would be helpful in terms of encouraging self-esteem in children. What are some things that you have found that encourage or develop self-esteem in children?
Recognizing very early that child's unique gifts and emphasizing those.
Okay, can you give me a specific example?
Billy can run fast. Not faster than anybody, it just is a gift he's given. And it's just really nice to see him do it.
All right.
Or so-and-so has a pretty smile, pretty hair, or says good morning, whatever.
So you would point out special things about children, individual uniqueness about them to the child. All right. Other ideas?
Just a smile or a hug to make them feel as though they're worthwhile human beings.
Right. Mm-hmm. To communicate love to children as a way of helping them feel their worth. Okay?
I remember growing up, my mother was German, very, very, I used to have to say she was very austere, but in her own way she was very loving, and we used to walk, do a lot of walking, and whenever we held hands, she would always squeeze her hand. And as I grew up, I didn't really understand why she squeezed my hand, and I asked her, and she said, well, when I squeeze your hand, it means three little words, and it says, I love you.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's nice. Mm-hmm.
That my mother's gone now, and I remember that, and I do that with my own children.
Mm-hmm.
Because for her, that was really something for her to say that.
Mm-hmm.
I know a teacher that did it, like on the shoulder to children, that she'd walk by and do the same thing.
Squeeze their shoulder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think it might be a good idea sometimes to compliment children when they do well in an area that they know they are not strong in. Like a child that always gets good grades,
mm-hmm.
but thinks of themselves as plain, could be complimented on their appearance. So
okay.
Go for the opposite, because otherwise you just keep reinforcing a certain path.
To try to strengthen areas
mm-hmm.
where children do not feel good about themselves.
Yeah, because you don't value what you're used to doing well, because that's all that.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
My husband and I heard a story from a person who, he was from a family who they had 14 children,
mm-hmm.
and the mother gave him such a special gift in that she made him feel like he was her most important child, our most special child. And here, only to find out years later that she did that with all her children.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they all felt like they were,
thought
the,
they
most,
were the most special
kids. Yeah.
Kid.
And he thought, all these years, you know, I thought I was the most important one. And she, you know, she made each of the children feel that.
It would be interesting to know how she accomplished that
yeah,
without creating that. Competition between the children.
Yeah, I heard that same story. It was related to a very old black man with many children.
Uh-huh.
And I was on his deathbed. And they were very, very poor.
Mm-hmm.
And he called in each child and said, don't tell any of the others, you
yeah.
know. But I want you to know at this moment that I have always pinned all of my hopes on you, and you are the greatest. And they all did fantastic. It wasn't until years later that they found out.
And by that time, they believed it and they weren't disillusioned.
That's right.
There's something about that bothers me, though.
I know.
You know, that's a difference between saying that you are good and holding you up as special without making you the most special.
Mm-hmm.
And the comparison sense, I think it's sort of like what Polly was saying to me in some ways.
There's always...
That can move beyond self-esteem to a sense of arrogance.
Exactly. There's a fine line there, I think, between feeling that you're important and being arrogant about it.
I think it's important to reaffirm in your children that they have the ability to do anything they set their mind to do.
Mm-hmm. What about being realistic with children? I was thinking about the child who was playing, maybe, or I was thinking more specifically of something like an athletic skill. You had talked about encouraging a child in an area in which they're weak, and that just passed through my mind, you know. But I think certainly you want to encourage them to try. Let me give you some kind of rules of thumb, and we can sort of take these one at a time and reflect on them. But some actions which encourage, and what I want to focus on really is how encouragement, which is what you've been saying, because you've talked about how you give the child that special hug, or you point out something that they're excelling in when they don't usually excel in that area. But let's think about how it is that we encourage children, because it's basically through encouragement that we're going to develop self-esteem in children. One thing that we can do, or one guideline that we might use, is that what one is doing is more important than how one is doing it. What one is doing is more important than how one is doing it. And what comes to my mind is young children who want to help cook. That's one of the crosses that I bear as a mother. We have this 12-year-old who loves to help cook. And I decided it was just real important that we have two sons, that they know how to cook. And so David was going to fix supper. Well, of course, you know, a cleanup was part of the deal, but the mess that he made in the process was really awesome. And I kept trying to think of the outcome and how important this was for him, and look more at and encourage what he was doing rather than how he did it. But I'm sure that there are other examples perhaps that you can think of when it would be important to look at what the child is doing rather than how expertly they are doing it.
Something to remember maybe in that aspect is just because you do it one way doesn't mean that's the only way it can be done. Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
A different way, it might be just as good. Just back off and let them do that.
That might apply. Yes, go ahead.
As they grow and learn new skills, like cooking, for instance, or sewing, or learning how to vacuum or dust or household chores, you know, it's more important that they're starting out and
until you get the child that's basically lazy and always for the last 13 years does something only half right.
Right.
Yes.
This is in the growing years.
How do you motivate excellence?
Yes, that's exactly. I mean, I think that what you're saying is very true in the beginning. But there comes a point where somehow you have to push them over that line and realize their potential.
Uh-huh. That's a good point. As they grow older.
But you should get better with practice. Then
you should.
Maybe the first time they cook, they cook like that, but each time they should get better. I think a dishwasher was made out of, you know.
Yes, I put them back in the sink.
You could.
Exactly.
You should get improved.
One of the examples in the book just blew one of my strategies for attempting this to pieces, because it talked about the child who tried to make their bed. And this was a young child, younger than our boys are. But it was really made very poorly. And the mother went right in and said, well, let me show you how, and, you know, made it up correctly. And, of course, the child was very discouraged because they had made the initial effort to try. And the example was to show you not to do that, of course. And then it said, and you don't do it later either, which is my strategy. Now, I wait till later, and then I go back and I tie it up, but that's not allowed either. Okay.
What would you say to that child instead?
What would you
say? The child who had made the bed.
How pleased you were that they had made their bed. They tried, and then the suggestion was that that you, let's see how it went, that you, another day, that you might be there and make, what would happen if, or suppose we rolled all the covers back and pulled them up one at a time rather than the, you know, all at once method.
Another day.
And then maybe when you change the whole bed, then let them help you change the bed to see how it was made in layers. And it sounds so reasonable when you read it, but when you walk by the room and you see it, you know, with this kind of method.
I think about it, my own experience of teaching high school is the whole process of giving feedback on papers and writing comments, and how you give criticism that's constructive and that does motivate for excellence, that is trying to push them to go beyond, you know, to improve their writing skill or improve their observation skill or whatever the goal of the assignment was.
Mm-hmm.
but that isn't just constant. I mean, even if they are sort of couched as constructive criticism, if that's even if that's all there is on the, in your comments, it can be very discouraging to a student to be sure to find those places where they, you know, something has come through real strongly, and to be sure to affirm that. Mm-hmm. But again, not to be pat about that. I had students complain and say, oh, you know, when a teacher lists a few positive things and then goes on to the negative, I know they don't really mean the positive, but, you know, it's like they pick up when you make comments that are just kind of rote in some sense.
Exactly.
But what you're really interested in is getting to what they didn't do well. Or, and so it's very hard to be, particularly when you have, as a high school student, you have a lot of papers every night, and to be creative with them, those that are encouraging,
right.
But that also that you don't get bogged down. So that's a particular kind of challenge for me.
Yeah.
But that whole balance of how you give feedback, particularly in written work, is what
that's
came
hard.
To my mind. Is quite a challenge.
I know as an English teacher, you know, one suggestion that someone gave to me was that you, in grading themes, that you grade them for one thing.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like you're only grading for the organization, or you only express. And so it doesn't look like a Christmas tree when you finish.
I often fall into the criticism trap. And to get myself out of that, I will write notes to the kids of something I see that they've done nice that day, and usually leave it on their bed. And recently I was helping my daughter clean her room, and I found she has kept every note she has ever received from me.
How neat.
That was the first time. I thought I was doing it just to help me get out of that rut.
Of always being negative. That's a very good suggestion. Yes, Barry.
I was just thinking in terms of your example of making the bed. I mean, isn't it often our lack of esteem that obstructs our being able to encourage and develop self-esteem in children? Because I mean I happen to be a particularly neat person, and it bugs me to no end.
It bugs me too.
it doesn't match. I'll tell you that. And it bugs me, but I'm not saying it bugs
me. My room is always a wreck.
Still is.
But I think
what I was going to say was that, you know, it's if I'm not a parent at this point, I've spent 12 years working with youth, but what would bother me about that would be just there's a certain order of things that would bother me about it, but it would most bother me if guests came over.
Exactly.
So then that reflects on me. Mm-hmm. And then you start to think, what difference does it make if this bed was made by this child and it doesn't look exactly like it came out of the Hilton Hotel? But that's really, that would be real hard for me, because that's my own insecurity about what other people are going to think about the way I raise my children. And yet, in doing that, then I obstruct their own self-esteem by being overly critical and having to have everything perfectly neat.
That's a good point. I saw some other things.
Parents have to somehow communicate and negotiate with their children through. I have the neatest daughter-in-law, and the bed was a big thing. But the twins negotiated with her that for so long they could just put their sleeping bags on the bed.
And that's it. David was loving.
It was peace and tranquility, because, you know, sleeping bags, you crawl in, and anybody see anything, the twins are in sleeping bags. Right. And, you know, you have to learn those things. You really have to learn to negotiate. The cooking, I can give you a wonderful story. Eric was same mother, would drive you crazy in the kitchen, flour all over, you know. This week, he's cooking at the Cowbells Cook-Off in Great Falls. He's learned one dish, and he can cook it. And Grandma, it's a good dish. But you know, you have to be willing to negotiate one thing. You don't do the bread baking more than once.
Right. One thing at a time.
Or you go out in the patio.
Yeah, you move yourself, remove yourself in the situation.
A child that wants to bake buns, and my kitchen's this big. And literally, the first time we did it in there, it was like I just took the bag and went,
yeah.
Well, then I thought, this is, I know it. I
can't
drive
handle
me
it.
Drink. Uh-huh.
So I just, it was warm one day, and she said she wanted to make buns, and I thought, well, you know, where can we do this? I went out the patio, because I can just take the boats to you out there.
Oh, that's a good idea. So you moved the operation instead of your body.
Right.
I thought you were going to move yourself.
I grew up with feather ticks, and of course, they are great, because, you know, you take the feather tick out of this bag, you wash the bag, you put it back in, and you go, and it's okay. That's how I would do it with my kids. That's my thing.
Yeah.
You just kind of go like that, then where do they come down the big heap, and that's the way they're supposed to be.
That's wonderful, huh? That's even maybe a little fancier than sleeping bags, but it accomplishes
right,
the same thing.
Right.
I saw a hand back here, I think. Yeah, I want to come back to what Barry said. I think that was a very helpful point. In terms of parent self-esteem, and that's certainly something that I ran into, that so often, you know, we think of our children as a mirror of ourselves or a reflection of ourselves. And what popped into my mind when I was reading, and again when Barry was speaking, was the grocery store. You know, how many, in this scene in the grocery store at the candy, you know, when they put it right beside the checkout line, and how children get away with screaming for candy, and somehow it's personal. I mean, we don't want our children to misbehave, and so we don't want other people to think that we can't control them, and so we end up giving in sometimes and buying them candy. And sometimes I've won on that. I can remember Mark lying down and storming because he wanted popcorn. I mean, he actually had a tantrum on the floor, and I really walked off and left him. He was about 5, and he finally got up and followed, which is what you're really supposed to do. So, but it was such an emotional experience. Until I finished, I was just exhausted, and I wasn't sure whether he hadn't really won in the end anyway. I should have just bought the popcorn.
I wonder though, with the neatness, not just bed making, but having a room that's an absolute shambles, is. I've read a lot of books that say the child's room is their own domain, let them have it their way.
Right.
And I've always had problems with that. And I, for years, didn't think it had to do with when the company comes over, because that's not a problem area for me. So did a lot of thinking and praying about it. And it suddenly, not suddenly, but gradually dawned on me that in this world, there's a certain semblance of order. Lots of chaos, but also a certain semblance of order. And that there's day and there's night and there's spring and summer and fall and winter, and there's a sense of order. And if the kids don't learn that sense of order at home, where are they going to learn it?
Mm-hmm.
I have 4 children, 2 that have that sense of order. They were just born with it, and they are basically neat. They are kids, and their rooms are messy, but they're basically neat. There's 2 kids that, if given the choice, would live with garbage in their room and pile under 6 months of laundry. They have no sense of order. And where are they going to learn that if they don't at home? And I think that sometimes it's not a matter of parents' self-worth, it's a matter of
order.
Yeah.
Of learning.
Sometimes.
I don't want to talk too much here, but my response to that is, maybe the key in there is that 2 of them are naturally orderly and 2 of them aren't. And
that's
maybe
it.
That needs to be heard. Maybe there's some creativity that comes out of that that those of us who are more ordered don't have. That's really hard for me to say, believe me. Especially my brother sitting there with the olive. I don't want an olive. Why they're more creative than I am. I'm not totally disagreeing with you either. I think that there really is something in a need for some organization.
Mm-hmm.
But I think at some point that there are people who simply,
well,
there's some positive things and
it's interesting
some
to me that
things.
Since I have finally decided that, okay, there is going to be some set rules that they must follow whether it's easy for them or not, their school grades have gone up. And I think that's because there's a discipline involved there, and school grades involve discipline too.
Sure.
There's a lot of interaction.
And maybe also they learn that they can receive the bottom line goal of not doing something. They get a certain attention. They have a certain power. And I'm not going to do it. And you'll fight and you'll fuss and you'll argue and so forth. If you're quicker to do it, actually, but you're getting a payoff.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'll go ahead and keep on doing it. Get some self-recognition.
To get some attention.
Way,
exactly.
That they don't get otherwise. And when you stop giving them that recognition for not doing something, you're quicker to do it.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Dreikers in this book talks about order and the need for order, and that children do need some parameters to work within, and I think there's a lot of truth in that. But I'm convinced that one of our children is naturally orderly and the other one is naturally disorderly.
Right, and that makes it hard because why is he getting off with this?
Exactly. Let me throw out another sort of rule of thumb here to refocus a little bit. Another point that kept coming up again and over again in some of the reading was that it's important that you look at the deed, or that you comment upon the deed and not the doer. Okay, that you comment upon the deed and not the doer. Would someone like to share an example, perhaps, that comes to your mind? Yes.
I think sometimes we're talking about perfectionism of parents pushing against, you know, the natural sloppiness or whatever of kids.
Uh-huh.
I think of my mom, who sometimes used shame to make me feel terrible about the fact that I hadn't finished all the dishes. And other times would just assign a numerical value and say, well, I think you've done about 87%. And leave it at that. Let me figure out the other 13%.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's a, you know, when you say, describe the deed, well, okay, you've done most of the job, but I still see a few things there.
Uh-huh.
Rather than to say, I can't believe it. Once again, you slimed up.
You know? You have to be careful about what you apply and what you say, I think, a lot of times. Some other examples you might have.
Do you think you can so neatly separate the deed from the doer? There's this old cliche in theology that God hates the sin and not the sinner, which, I mean, certainly has some truth in it, but I'm a little leery, I guess, of trying to draw too much of a separation, and that I think a healthy individual, there are times when one ought to feel shame. And I'm not exactly sure when that is. I know that can feel oppressive and all this, but
An example, I guess, and I think you're right, that you can't completely, but to say to a child, it makes me very angry that the tools are in the yard and they're rusted or something damaged, as opposed to saying, you were stupid to leave the tools in the yard. Maybe. Because they're closely related, but you don't name call, almost, I guess. So.
I don't have an example, but I do have a question that we have. How do you deal with the aggression? You were talking about deeds being relatively benign, whether we're sloppy or whether we're neat.
Mm-hmm.
But when your children get aggressive with each other,
mm-hmm,
and start to hurt each other, that's one of those areas where it must be very important to separate the deed from the doer. But I don't have an example. Obviously, I don't do it very well. I tend to just get aggressive back.
You can't hit that, brother. Right?
So how do you do that? What are the actions? How can you foster that when that aggression that just sparks off?
Mm-hmm.
And then, anybody have any ideas? I don't.
I had an example that worked for me last week. I don't know if it'll ever work again. The girls were bickering, and they've been doing this a lot recently, and I had fallen into the criticism trap once again. And they started bickering over who was going to push the shopping cart in the grocery store, and one hit the other. And I turned around and I said, I don't want this in the store, you may go sit in the car. And after a couple of repetitions, they cried and stomped themselves out and sat in the car and fought out there. And I thought and thought and thought, okay, what am I going to do? I want to give some positive reinforcement. What here is positive? So when we got home, they had to write sentences. And even my six-year-old, who's just not even in first grade yet, she had to write down on a piece of paper 15 times, I am kind and loving. And my 10-year-old, who was really the aggressor in this one, wrote, I am a kind and loving person, and on the other side of the paper, I am thoughtful and considerate. It worked for the entire day, because one time later in the afternoon, they started bickering at me, and they said, what were the sentences you wrote? And they thought about it, said it, and they didn't fight again that day. I don't know how often I could get away with it. I don't know, but it worked that one time.
Fighting is a frustrating issue, though.
It's said that it takes 13 positives to negate a negative. And I'm not into metaphysics, but I've been reading. I'm an RN who's into therapeutic massage and therapeutic touch and that type of thing, and polarity therapy. I've gotten hold of a book called You Can Heal Your Life by Louise Alkay, and it talks about what you're talking about working with your subconscious and you know, reinforcing to yourself that you love yourself and all that type of thing. And boy, I tell you, that stuff is powerful, because we're talking about self-esteem and we're talking about the hurts that we all undergo from infancy. And I really believe that it does take 13 strokes to undo one harsh comment. That by reinforcing the subconscious, it becomes a part of your inner being, as does forgiveness, you know.
That's interesting. Yes.
That's a good key, forgiveness. I have a problem with the doer and the deed. It reminds me of someone who has done something wrong and I like you, but I don't like what you did. Uh-huh. I mean, that was a separation of years back, which I never felt comfortable with either, because I'm not going to like this person because of what he did. You know, I guess I'm still not satisfied with what we were talking about, the deed and the doer and the separation.
Yes. Okay.
Onto the doer and the deed. There's something called labeling effect, too. Like, if you have a child and you're used to saying, you are bad, you know, why did you do that? They're going to grow up thinking, I am bad. You know, whereas for what you did, you know, what was wrong, there's a big difference in that, you know. Whereas for if what you always say is, you know,
you are
how bad. Could you have done that? You were, you know, you were, then there, it does get into you.
That's true, but I wouldn't say it. I mean, I wouldn't be labeling, I would just not say anything, because I'm not going to say, I like you, but I don't like what you did, because at that moment, I don't feel that way at all.
Mm-hmm. Or even on the other side of it, you are a good girl, you are a good boy. And then in their heads, they know things that they've done, and know I'm not a good, you know, no, I'm not good. And if you compliment the deed or what they've done, then it's different than saying you are good, and then they're like, no, I'm not.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, essentially what that is supposed to do is to say that the person is not defined by one deed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, the person is
more. That's sort of the purpose of that.
I guess.
The child is not defined by anything that they do. I mean, if you want to, you know, take seriously the developmental sciences and the developing character of each person, then you have to say, in effect, it is never important, and it will never be important to that child, whether or not the bed was made on that day, or whether or not the flower was on the floor, or whatever. If we push that hard to think that, you know, these things are going to somehow either affect our child or not affect them, I think we can get too much into that perfectionism for right now, rather than setting the child up to be someone with self-esteem and someone who will choose valuable and correct and orderly behaviors later on.
Mm-hmm. I think that there's nothing more encouraging for self-esteem than unconditional love. I don't love you because you get good grades, because then if you don't get good grades, that means I don't love you because you're pretty, because then if you have an accent. But the unconditional love, I believe it, but for a long time didn't quite know how to really communicate that. Mm-hmm. Well, God gave me one of my children so I would grow. He has shattered every concept of parenting I have had since he was an infant, and continues to do so. I've been growing very painfully for a number of years. And
but you've weathered it well.
Pardon?
You look like you've weathered it well.
Oh, sometimes, I don't know. This one particular day, it was divine intervention, I'm absolutely positively sure. The child often has trouble controlling a temper. And this particular day, he had a hissy fit and was threatening me with a stick. And this was he was really threatening me with a large stick. And I looked right at him, and I was able to say and mean it, really mean it. And it was the turning point in our relationship. And this happened like a year and a half ago, and it has really mellowed since then. As he's taking the stick and going like this, I just looked at him and I said, I will love you. Even if you're evil, I will love you. And it was just like everything shattered inside of him. And I turned around and walked out of the room. And when he calmed himself, then it has been an entirely different relationship since then. And I know that those words came from somewhere other than me. Because I was scared. Mm-hmm. I was really scared. But to me, the bottom line of self-esteem is always unconditional love. Mm-hmm.
Next and forward.
I know someone who's done that also in her family and has done it very well. And the kid's self-esteem is absolutely a disaster.
Really?
Yeah. All of them are just, they're walking disasters because it has been unconditional love without ever admitting that what they are doing is not acceptable.
To me, oftentimes the loving thing is to say no. Yeah. And that's hard, and it's hard to make them understand it. I don't mean being a doormat by unconditional love.
Yeah.
What I mean is that, no, I'm not going to let you hit me with that stick, but even though you're attempting to, I still love you. And there's a real fine line between being a doormat, and oftentimes the loving thing to do is not the popular thing to do.
What would you have done if you had hit you?
Cried. I truly, truly don't know. I just am glad I didn't have to find out. I don't know. I don't know.
Yes.
Going back to deed and doer, when you define a deed instead of labeling a child, you give the child something to work on, something he can correct, he, she. They know what they've done wrong. We've defined it. We don't hit in this family.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't right to scream in church. You know, we don't scream in church. They can then work on that behavior rather than a statement of you are a bad boy, a clumsy this, or whatever. It's pretty hard to work, define what, when you're a child, what's a bad and what's a good. It's hard for adults. You know, children don't yet have that concept. So if you can label what it is, then they can work on it.
Right. Looks like we have other folk arriving. Another thing that I wanted us to have more time to talk about was the whole issue of giving children responsibility. And we have not really touched on that at all. Let me recommend a book to you that I'm finding helpful. It's one that I'm using this week, and it's in the bookstore. This book is called People Making by Virginia Satir. It's not a really pretty new book, but one that someone who does a lot of parenting sessions in our church recommended to me. Two other things that I did not have ordered, but in case you are looking for materials to use, this came from my mother-in-law, as a matter of fact. The Parents Handbook, STEP, is the name of it. I'd be happy to show this to any of you after, but it's a very, it's almost like a teacher's manual in terms of ideas and activities that you might do. This one is for elementary age children and preschoolers, and then there's a sequel that is for teens. And I feel like probably the area that we didn't really touch at all, or not a lot, was looking specifically at teens and building self-esteem in teens. But I certainly thank you for coming and for being so willing to share. It's very helpful.